first to the US and our regular conservative commentator, Daniel McCarthy. Daniel, welcome back.
Thank you.
Can we begin with the continuing horror movie of Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance? We just heard on the news the Turkish officials who claim they have the audio recording, which graphically records his murder, are unwilling to share it at this stage. How is the story being received in Washington?
It's generated a great deal of shock and fury to a degree that, you know, might not even have been expected. Khashoggi has really put a human face on Saudi oppression and abuse. It's a deeply personal thing for many people here in Washington, D.C., because Khashoggi was someone that people might run into at various events around town. He was someone whose byline was seen in the Washington Post. And so it's really has humanized a rather atrocious, record that the Saudis have.
And, of course, the response from the White House is, to say the least, ambiguous.
To say the least, that's right. And it's been interesting to see that a number of other Republicans in Congress have actually spoken out much more forcefully. Marco Rubio has done so, so has Lindsey Graham, and so have a number of others. And it does seem as if the administration is rather embarrassed and in a difficult position as a result of this. They've invested so much in the relationship with Mohammed bin Salman that they're desperately trying to find a way that something that would mitigate what seems to have happened here. And the facts just don't seem to back up anything less than the worst impression.
Daniel, they're trying to really tie Trump up in Nazi, but he's far and all. He's not the only U.S. president to have uncomfortably close ties with the Saudis. Both the Bushes, father and son, were equally friendly.
That's right. And in general, I think it's a mistake when people say that the United States and its attitude towards a foreign regime is responsible for the behavior of a dictator. Whether it's Mohammed bin Salman now or whether it was Assad during the Obama years, it simply isn't the case that the United States has the power to control what these characters do. The nature of their regimes, the nature of their unchecked power is what allows them to commit these abuses and atrocities. The United States, you know, might be able to say a few words and, you know, apply a few sanctions, but fundamentally the nature of the regimes themselves is what's responsible for these horrors.
Talking about ambiguities, Mike Pompeo's visit to Saudi Arabia to meet with the king and crown prince, his behaviour seemed, rather gentle. And what about that strange comment of his that he doesn't want to discuss the facts?
It's very strange indeed. And in general, Pompeo's trip out to Saudi Arabia seems to have served very little purpose. They weren't discussing the facts. They don't seem to have come to any sort of clear conclusion. And instead, there's this tendency to say that there are still open questions here, when in fact there are very few questions that are still open. Even without the audio recordings that the Turks claim to have being made public, there does seem to be a great deal of verification of the Turkish stories appearing in newspapers ranging from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times. So the facts seem pretty solid.
Daniel, I want to talk about the big money that's at stake here. And two amounts come to mind. The $100 million that landed in the US's bank account and the $100 billion in arms deals. Take us through what's at stake for the Trump administration.
Well, that's right. So the Saudi Arabia is a significant sort of bankroller of various kinds of U.S. activity in the Middle East right now. So the Saudis have provided $100 million for U.S. Operations and work in Syria. And then they've also have this, they're a major purchaser of United States arms, and Donald Trump does not want to damage that relationship. On the contrary, he wants to sell more weapons to them. The U.S. arms industry employs a lot of people, and Donald Trump, is an economic nationalist. He views this as an industry that he wants to make sure is still strong and secure. But on Capitol Hill, among, congressmen, including Republican congressmen and senators, there's a great deal of outrage. So Senator Rand Paul, for example, the Republican from Kentucky, really wants to prevent these arms deals from going through and to penalize the Saudis.
Whilst some of the Republicans are genuinely horrified, others seem to feel it's a distraction from the real enemy.
That's true. There is a certain degree of exasperation from Republican hawks who are primarily concerned about Iran. And they see this not only as a distraction from the questions of what activities Iran is undertaking in the region, but also they see it as damaging to a relationship with an ally, or at least an ally of convenience against Iran. And Saudi Arabia has been, for one thing, bankrolling Iranian opposition groups, and in general has been one of the leading forces trying to check or target Iran in the region. So the Iran hawks are inconvenienced, to say the least, and to some degree they are quite upset that their game plan has been disrupted by the fact that Saudi Arabia is now the focus of attention.
Daniel, the 2016 election campaign is still fresh in our memories, and yet you're gearing up for 2020. I see CNN has released a list of the Democratic candidates most likely to take on Trump, and let's look at the top names. There's Biden at 33%, Sanders at 13%, Kamala Harris from California at 9%, Elizabeth Warren, and we'll talk more of her later, a mere 8%, and Cory Booker, 5%. Make your choice, if you would.
Well, I think as the poll reflects, Joe Biden would be by far the strongest opponent to President Trump in 2020. At least as things stand now. There are certain questions, first of all, about how Joe Biden's long record as a U.S. senator would affect him, especially in Democratic primaries. Biden, at various times has sponsored things like the 1994 crime bill, which I think today would be seen as, being more harsh than the Democratic Party would want to accept. And also, Biden seems to be showing his age at times. He's, about the same age as Donald Trump. But he does seem to occasionally have memory lapses and other difficulties. Of the other candidates, there's sort of this division between the candidates who appeal to Democrats on the basis of identity politics and the candidates who appeal to them on the basis of sort of left-wing economics. And there may be an irreconcilable divide there.
Okay, let's look at Elizabeth Warren. Repeatedly called Pocahontas by the president. Tell us about her troubled week.
Yes, Elizabeth Warren, in her earlier career as an academic, had for quite some time presented herself as having Native American, American Indian heritage. And in quite a bold way, she contributed recipes to cookbooks claiming to be Native American. She listed herself as being among the very few sort of diverse non-white faculty at Harvard University. And the problem was, this was all pretty much a scam. This is all false. She doesn't have very much Native American heritage. She did just this week release the results of a DNA test, which showed that she did have, some very small percentage, less than 1% by far, of Native American DNA, supposedly. These tests are not 100% accurate. But it seems as if she actually has less Native American heritage than the average American does.
Well, so she's the Cherokee Nation certainly aren't buying it. And so it's an indication of the pitfalls, I guess, of identity politics for white progressives.
It's very much so. Elizabeth Warren wanted to be something more than just a white-bred liberal progressive, but she's tried to take on an identity which really doesn't belong to her. And the Cherokee Nation, has quite forcefully issued statements saying that, first of all, DNA tests are not what they use to determine membership in the nation. And second of all, she just simply does not qualify based on her heritage.
I must say that I look at the list, Biden, Sanders, Harris, Warren and Booker, with a sense of befuddlement. I am astonished that your mighty nation, with its hundreds of millions of population, cannot come up with a more exciting choice.
Well, it is an interesting list. Kamala Harris has been a state office holder in California for some time. It is the country's largest state, so that gives her a certain amount of sort of momentum within the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders certainly made a very strong impression on people in 2016. So there is, I don't want to say a great deal of strength in the list, but there certainly is a certain amount of variety and a certain amount of, you know, superficial plausibility. But no, there's no silver bullet. But then again, you know, I mean, in 2016, the Democrats thought, especially at the beginning, that they had a sort of perfect candidate in Hillary Clinton, someone who had been on the national scene a long time, had a great deal of experience, and was kind of perhaps acceptable to every faction of their party. And Clinton turned out, in fact, to be a much weaker candidate than expected. So the results of these sort of primaries and then the general election don't always follow the predictable path.
How do you feel about the midterms? What's your guess at the moment?
You know, my best guess is that the Republicans will lose somewhat over 20 seats in the House of Representatives, and that means they will lose control of the House of Representatives next year. On the other hand, I think that Donald Trump is actually going to lose fewer seats this year than Barack Obama lost in 2010 or than Bill Clinton lost in 1994. It looks to me as if Donald Trump is actually not going to suffer quite the wipeout that the last two Democratic presidents did. And I think that's going to be difficult for a lot of commentators to wrap their minds around, because I think they want to say that Donald Trump is a sort of failure on a level that you know, is unprecedented in American politics.
Daniel, forgive me. I find it hard to wrap my mind around it.
Well, you know, Donald Trump's popularity ratings, while they're not sky high, they're also not sort of rock bottom. They've been in the, you know, 40s for most of his term. And, you know, many of Donald Trump's policies are more popular than one would think from the coverage they receive in the press. Things like, you know, his tariffs and economic nationalism, for example.
Daniel, thanks for your time. Daniel McCarthy, columnist for The Spectator USA and editor of Modern Age, a conservative review.